Good evening. I would like to welcome you to the first meeting of IBRI, the Interdisciplinary Biblical Research Institute. Tonight we are very pleased to have Dr. John Studenroth speak to us on the glory of God as revealed in the microscope. Dr. Studenroth received both his B.S. and his M.S. in botany and plant pathology from the University of Maine. He then went to Cornell, where he completed his Ph.D. in plant pathology. Afterwards, went to seminary, Biblical Theological Seminary, where he received his Master's of Divinity and has done postgraduate work at Dropsy College of Hebrew and Cognate Learning. He is presently teaching biology at Pinebrook Junior College, and we are very happy to have him with us this evening. Dr. Studenroth.
Thank you very much, Barry. Of all those various degrees and institutions he's listing, the most edifying was by far Biblical Theological Seminary for being a student. And of all the careers I've had, Pinebrook Junior College is by far the most edifying of all the jobs I've ever tried to master. Let's just pause for a word of prayer before we begin. Father, I thank you for the opportunity to be here tonight. Thank you, Lord, as I look around this building, I can just see your hand of blessing upon this school and the physical improvement of the plant. Lord, our prayer is that you would continue to bless spiritually also the many students who come through these doors and then go on to fields of service, might be well equipped for whatever you have for them. Thank you for the faithful faculty that minister here. And Lord, I just pray that you would bless this evening as we consider your handiwork in creation. I pray that this would be just one more blessing to us to help us sense the great confidence we can have in you. What a great and wise God you are. What a good creator you are. So may we see your goodness, may we see your wisdom and glory in it tonight. And may we go forth from here somewhat better equipped to serve you. And we'll thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. The verse that was quoted on the advertisement for tonight's talk is a verse I used in the frontispiece of my PhD dissertation at Cornell. And it simply reads like this, Proverbs 25:2. It is the glory of God to conceal a matter, but the glory of kings is to search out a matter. God rather enjoys concealing things, and we rather enjoy trying to find them. Maybe it's like parents setting up a treasure hunt for their children for a birthday party. But God takes pleasure in his creation, and I wish young people could capture that more. And I stress that when I teach biology at Pinebrook Junior College. You find the humor of God as well as the vivid imagination of God, the artistry of God, his love of beauty. All these things are in his creation and are part of the attributes that are revealed through the natural creation. Tonight we want to consider some of the wisdom and majesty and the sophistication that God has wrapped into his creation. When I put this in the frontispiece of my thesis, the glory of God to conceal a matter, but the glory of kings is to search out a matter, I put a footnote on kings, an asterisk, and then down below I have asterisks or scientists who receive federal research grants. Because we don't have that many kings in our culture. But we do have a lot of scientists who get grants from NIH and NSF and other foundations, usually taxpayers' money finding its way to their pockets. And that's good. There's no harm in that. I think our nation has been greatly blessed. The entire world has been blessed by the financial resources we've been able to put into the scientific enterprise. But all we're doing when we do the scientific enterprise is thinking God's thoughts after him. As John Kepler said so many years ago in the field of astronomy, I think thy thoughts after thee, O God. And that's what we're going to be doing tonight as we look at first the green plant as a macroscopic entity that we can see with the naked eye. Then we're going to get somewhat finer resolution. We're going to look at a single cell that would require a light microscope to visualize. Then we're going to go down to a tiny organelle in that cell called a ribosome that would require an electron microscope to visualize. And then we're going to look at the virus, again requiring an electron microscope, and some details of that virus that even an electron microscope would not show us, but other techniques have revealed. So we're going more and more finely in resolution as we follow God's thoughts after him. Starting with the green plant, do we have any engineers here tonight? Anybody? Okay. What type of engineer, may I ask? Mechanical. And yourself? Same. Two mechanical engineers. Good. For fun tonight, I want to consider that we're all engineers, and we've just been given an assignment. And I'm going to tell you before I even begin to do this little metaphor, this allegory, that this is not original with me, nor is it original with any particular Christian. It comes from a secular plant physiology textbook that's used in undergraduate courses, Salisbury and Ross to be particular. At least it was used back in my undergraduate days in the late 60s. Who knows what has transpired since then? But it is an example of how even unbelieving plant physiologists can see what we're aiming at here tonight. They used this analogy to help students perceive just how difficult it would be to design a green plant. Let's imagine that one of our space probes has explored a planet deep in space that's very similar to Earth, has many of the same attributes as planet Earth, similar atmosphere, similar temperature, gravitation. So it looks like we've finally found one that we can land men on and start colonizing with not too much difficulty. Now, all the probes we've sent would indicate there's no human life on this planet, and really no life at all. It's just the conditions are the same as Earth, atmospherically, geologically, abiotically, if you will, non-life-wise. This planet's like ours, but we have not found any trace of bacteria or plant or animal life of any type. What we want to do, what NASA wants to do, with whatever dollars they have available to them, is to colonize it, but first they want to prepare it for colonization. And the task of our task as engineers is to design an unmanned robot that will land ahead of the colonizers who are coming. And this little robot is going to begin to prepare the way, sounds like John the Baptist, prepare the way for this, in a wilderness, no less, prepare the way for the human followers who are going to come later. And here's what it has to do. Here are some of the specifications. First, this robot's going to be capable of synthesizing complex organic compounds, carbohydrates, proteins, lipids, things that the future astronauts will need when they arrive for food substances. They'll need other things like vitamins, pigments, and hormones, and cellulose. This little robot that we're designing is going to produce cellulose, which will be a structural material that can be used for building all sorts of things once they arrive. What's available to this robot for raw materials that it can in turn use to make these things? Primarily salts. It's going to have various salts in the soil. It will have water. It will have carbon dioxide available to it. Now, since the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is available in very small percentages, about 3 parts per 10,000, which incidentally is what we have here on Earth, it will have to process about 4 tons of air, 100,000 cubic feet, to get 1 pound of carbon. That's 4 tons of atmospheric air to get 1 pound of carbon for incorporation into these organic compounds. And if you know anything about organic compounds, they're mostly carbon. Long chains of carbon atoms form proteins, carbohydrates, lipids, all the things we think of as food. Now, this robot must basically use sunlight to get the energy it needs to synthesize all these things. The water that it's obtaining is in the soil, but is often very scarce and has to pull it against great pressure against the soil particles, has to remove it from the soil particles with considerable difficulty. Many of the minerals that it needs are very scarce, and many of the minerals it doesn't need are quite plentiful. So there has to be a careful selectivity. The robot has to choose often what are the minor elements available and reject those that are there in rather large quantity. Okay, how large a payload am I talking about? What's the size of this engineering package that we're going to design? Well, you're not given unlimited space. NASA, with some budget cutbacks, is using rather small boosters these days. Our payload, they tell us, when we start out, will be the size of a small pearl, just a little piece of jewelry. And everything we're going to do is going to be in that little pearl. Now, you can subdivide this little pearl all you want to into literally millions of little modular compartments, no problem. Make as many modules in there as you want, each one about the size of a speck of dust. And you're going to be doing a lot of chemistry in these modules. So you're not restricted in how many or what types you have or what styles of modules, just the size. Okay, upon arrival, this robot will first increase its own size. It's one of the first things it does is begin to swell and expand and grow. And how does it grow? It can utilize some of the organic substances that it's programmed to make. We said you're going to make lipids and carbohydrates and proteins. Well, you may use some of them. Don't use all of them. You're going to have some for the astronauts when they come, but you certainly use some of them as you produce them. Now, initially, there will be a tiny amount of stored material in the pearl. You can have a little bit of lipid, a little bit of carbohydrate and protein for just to get things rolling, prime the pump, if you will. But once you get rolling, you've got to produce all your own things. Because very quickly, you're going to exhaust this onboard supply, and you're going to have to start using the water, the carbon dioxide, and the minerals that I mentioned. You need to also have in these little modules blueprints. Background information, how to build things structurally, and even how to make all the proteins. All the proteins we're going to make are specific proteins. And we're going to have the information that will tell exactly the amino acid sequence of every protein we're going to make and the structure of every carbohydrate and lipid we're going to make. Okay, as the robot increases in size, it's going to have to provide itself with a supply and transport system between its parts in the soil and its parts in the air. The thing's going to grow larger. It's going to be producing, pulling minerals out of the soil. It has to transport them up. It's going to be taking sunlight. It has to transport things down. So we need some sort of internal transportation system. It can't get too large because it will begin to exhaust the available resources. We have a limited number of resources in any given vicinity in the soil. And this thing can't just pick up and move. Once it puts down its appendages into the soil to pick up minerals and water, those are very fragile appendages. You can't just pull them up, go over 3 feet, and stick them back in again. You stay where you're put. Which means we're going to be limited in the size we'll finally achieve. And the secret now is to reproduce. So what we're asking your little pearl-sized robot to do is have within it the blueprint for reproduction that it can make many more robots with modular compartments that can then grow in size, produce all the things that are needed, and make still more generations. We eventually want to populate a large portion of this planet with little robots, all producing the needed raw materials. So we've got to have blueprints in there for baby robots, if you will. Now, the intricacy of this robot, I think you begin to see that it is a rather intricate instrument, means it has to be protected from certain violent forces and changes in the environment on the planet. It must, for example, withstand the heating effects of full sunlight, the shearing effects of windstorms, and the destructive effects of rapid temperature changes, as well as sharp temperature gradients from one end to the other. I'm going to skip over some of this. I think you all get the picture pretty rapidly here. Let me come down the home stretch by saying that this little robot also has to be smart enough to anticipate seasonal changes. For this time of year, as we are right now, winter is coming. It has to anticipate that. Now, you can program into it measuring of time. It can measure the length of day and night. It can be very sensitive to different light intensities and different light qualities. But as it senses the colder season coming, it has to provide its own antifreeze, its own mechanism to endure and be there again in the spring season. Don't you wish your car could do that? Just sort of sensed it, and the antifreeze was added, and everything was cool. And then, of course, your baby robots have to have all this information programmed to them, too. They have to be able to, as they come into the first winter season, anticipate it, provide for it, etc. I think you get the point. What we're saying is, and this is how these men concluded this little allegory, they said these are only a few of the more basic requirements and specifications for our space probe robot. The fact is that no committee of scientists and engineers on the face of the Earth could begin to duplicate, now I'm adding this word, what God has done with a simple seed that grows into a green plant. They're marveling at it. Here are some, as far as I know, unbelieving plant physiologists who are marveling at the seed of a kernel of corn or a pea, a grain of wheat. And they just say, we couldn't do it. We can follow it, but we can't do it. And I'm saying, that's right. The only thing I'm adding is the word God. What God has done, we can think his thoughts after, and we can marvel at this invention, this engineering feat, so compressed, so tiny, and so sophisticated. Well, plants are a favorite of mine. I quickly majored in botany when I went to college. My mother was one who had house plants all over the house, and I didn't realize what an effect she was having on me until I got away from it, got to college. I knew I wanted to major in biology. It only took one semester of zoology, the study of the animals, to persuade me I wanted to be a botanist. And there was botany all the way after that for me. And I was fascinated when I learned one day in my reading that the whole subject of photosynthesis, how green plants take sunlight and make all these complex organic compounds, is a subject so vast, so incredibly broad and deep, that in 1945, a man named Eugene Rabinowitz said, I'm going to write a treatise on the subject, and I will include in my writings everything we know to this point. It will be an exhaustive survey of all we know about photosynthesis. He finished in 1956, 11 years later. He had a three-volume treatise, and it was totally out of date by the time it was finished. Three volumes, a masterpiece, no question about it, but so much had been learned during the 11 years in which he was pulling together what we knew that it was outdated before he could get it on the shelves. And since that time, it has been said that no man could possibly hope to tackle a similar task to what that gentleman set out to do. That we have learned so much about photosynthesis that you cannot possibly read rapidly enough in the field to stay abreast of all that's being learned day after day in laboratories around the world. If your son or daughter came to you and said, I love plants and I want to be a botanist, and more specifically, I want to be a plant physiologist, and more specifically than that, I want to spend the rest of my life looking at photosynthesis, how plants take sunlight and make food. You may say, boy, you're getting really narrow, aren't you? No, not nearly narrow enough. Your son or daughter will find, when they get to graduate school, if not sooner, that they must subdivide into one of 500 subdisciplines within the realm of photosynthesis. I just received that number this past summer. I went to an ASA conference, and Kurt Wise, our old friend, was there, and he was talking to a friend of his who's a plant physiology major who indeed is studying photosynthesis. So this little anecdote that I like to tell suddenly became real to me when he said, I have a friend like that who just went to an international conference on photosynthesis, and he said there are 500 chemical reactions, and you need to pick one and specialize in it. And most of them are untouched. He said there's only three or four that we understand very well. The rest are virtually virgin territory. So there's room for your sons and daughters if they want to be students of photosynthesis. There's lots of room. I always marveled at a gentleman at Cornell named Dr. Andre Jagendorf, who was an internationally renowned scholar in this field, who studied, and tonight in the overhead you'll be seeing exactly what he studied. He studied what's called the thylakoid membranes within the chloroplast, a very tiny subunit of one chloroplast. And he always studied in spinach, too. He was always grinding up spinach leaves and getting out the chloroplast. And this man was graduating PhDs virtually every year. Every year, at least one PhD would get his degree at Cornell studying under this man to then go out and find a job and put bread and butter on the table. And there were jobs waiting for them out there. Men who had studied the thylakoid membrane inside the chloroplast, inside the spinach cells. How much information can there be in one spinach chloroplast? Enough to make PhDs every year and never run out. Just so much to be learned about these things. You know, the closer we examine God's handiwork, the more profound and sophisticated and beautiful it becomes. Unlike man's work, I don't know if you've ever taken a microscope and looked at anything man has made. One of the first exercises we do in an introductory biology course is teach students how to use a light microscope. And those who come to us with a deprived childhood and they never had one in high school, you try to not have them drive the turrets right through the slide and crack the slide and break the lens. And one of the things you do is practice with a slide that has a letter E mounted on it. It's not too expensive. If they break that slide, you haven't lost too much. And it helps them teach them how to focus and how to move the slide around and keep it in the field of view. But they notice as they start in low power, it just looks like a big black letter E. This is simply cut out of a newspaper or a magazine, cleared and mounted on a permanent slide, and it looks like a letter E. Then you go up to a medium power, about 100 magnification. Now the E fills the whole field of view, and it looks just a little bit tattered and ragged around the edges. And then you go to 400 power. And now you're so large you can't even see the whole letter E, and you have to just move around looking at portions of this letter. But as you come to the edge of the letter, you see all the paper fibers and ink. It's just a tangled mess. Very ugly. And you say, well, it looked like a nice, clear, sharp letter E. Even you folks with your Hewlett-Packard laser printers challenge you to put it under the microscope, and you'll see that the edge of that nice, sharp, laser-printed production is really very ragged. Take integrated circuits. When I was a child, integrated circuits were just coming into their own. My dad was a pastor. One of the men in his church was working for Fairchild Semiconductors in South Portland, and he would occasionally bring me a little integrated circuit that had been tossed in the trash can. They were very expensive in those days, and to get a faulty one for free was a real joy. Get under my microscope and look at this little city of wires, all these things running around, little resistors and everything, poured in molten metal into these tiny little chips. Just such fascination. But then as you magnified it, it was crude. What looked like such fine series of wires, such beauty, it becomes more and more crude as you magnify it more and more. Just globules of molten metal. Unlike what God does. And tonight as I show you this, you're going to see that as you look deeper and deeper, it doesn't lose any of that beauty. There's just another layer of beauty, and still a deeper layer of beauty. And it's all very well organized. Okay, we're starting with a single cell then. That was the green plant. That was a little background into the whole subject of photosynthesis. I want to, as our second topic tonight, think about the single cell. At this point, we're going to begin to use some overheads. I'm going to torment you and torture you tonight with the overheads that my students often have to look at in biology class. You can relax tonight. You won't be quizzed next week on these things. This is just an ideal cell. This is not really a cell of anything. It's just an artist's conception of the idealized animal cell, very similar to our own human cells. You have around the outside what's called a cell membrane. I'm going to try to use my pencil as a pointer tonight and lay it right on the overhead. This outer sheet, might look like a sheet of cellophane, wrapping the whole cell, is called the cell membrane and is very thin, very flexible, semi-permeable is the technical term they use, and that means that the cell is in full control of what goes in and out of the cell, as we mentioned with the green plant. A lot of times the things in the environment of the cell are in high concentrations that would be toxic to the cell. And this membrane has the ability to keep out things that are not desirable. And it has the ability to selectively permit in and selectively permit out only those things that should go in and out for the health and welfare of that cell. Very sophisticated. I didn't even bring the overheads tonight that show the enlargement of a membrane, but I will make this comment. Many of you know Dr. John Bloom, who's also a member of IBRI. His PhD at Cornell was in biophysics. He studied under Dr. Webb, I believe was his name, who in turn had John studying the membranes of red blood cells. These were empty red blood cells. They call them ghosts. They're just the membrane, and all the contents are emptied out of them. And John used a laser beam to examine these membranes, and he obtained a PhD degree from Cornell, simply looking at cell membranes of emptied out red blood cells. And his professor graduates many students with PhDs. And so everything I told you about photosynthesis and how you can keep awarding higher degrees to men to look at chloroplasts is also true just of the membrane that wraps the cell. There is so much happening in that lipid bilayer with its dynamic movement of proteins and carbohydrates. And what looks to us like a thin piece of plastic wrapping around the cell, no, that's filled with important, sophisticated equipment and worthy of many PhD degrees. Well, that's just the wrapper. What do we have inside? The analogy I like to give for all the contents of the cell is something like a city. You can picture one of our major cities like Philadelphia, Chicago, or New York City, and think, what goes on in a city? Well, there's City Hall. There's hopefully some form of government, some sort of mayor's office. That's the center, the nucleus. The nucleus of a cell is City Hall. And indeed, there are documents in City Hall that govern everything that's happening in the entire city. There are blueprints for every building in the city. Indeed, there's a double set of blueprints. There are two sets of blueprints in that City Hall that tell you everything that's going on in that city, all the enzymes and all the organelles. We call it the nucleus. Inside the nucleus is a smaller body called the nucleolus. You might think that's the mayor sitting in his chair, but the nucleolus is really, for whatever reasons, I don't know why the Lord designed it this way, it's a little factory in there that produces ribosomes. And later we're going to take a closer look at ribosomes. They are the little chefs or engineers that make proteins out in the cytoplasm. You know, when cells were first discovered back in the 17th century, men like Robert Hooke and Leeuwenhoek with their very crude microscopes, the word cell, incidentally, comes from Robert Hooke, who said these things look like the cells of a monastery. He was looking at dead pork cells originally. They just looked like little boxes. He said they looked like the rooms of a monastery, and I'll call them cells. There's that Judeo-Christian influence that these people don't like. They don't remember anymore where that word cell came from, from the monastery. Then scientists by 1830s began to realize there's a lot going on in these little boxes, and they called the whole jelly, it looked like jelly to them, they called it protoplasm. Then as we became a little more sophisticated, we said, well, there's always a nucleus, so let's call that nucleoplasm, and everything outside the nucleus we call cytoplasm. Well, now we get a little more sophisticated every year, and they keep naming more and more juicy little tidbits out here in the cytoplasm. One of the reasons I enjoy teaching introductory biology so much is every couple of years the textbooks are revised, and I get to catch up once again with what they're discovering in the cytoplasm. They're always adding new things. There's always more being learned about the numerous organelles. Just some of the more obvious ones, mitochondrion is the energy plant, the power plant. Any city has to have a power plant, whether it's nuclear or conventional, producing electricity. In this case, we're producing a substance called ATP, adenosine triphosphate. That is like the gasoline that powers any living organism. And so that is produced in mitochondria. Mitochondria take sugars, they burn it, they use oxygen, they give off carbon dioxide. You say, hey, that sounds like me. I eat food, I breathe oxygen, and I give off carbon dioxide. Well, you are the net result of trillions of mitochondria. That's what you are. You're sitting there with trillions of mitochondria and all your trillions of cells doing this. And you breathe in oxygen. Where do you think it's going? It's going to all your mitochondria. And you breathe out carbon dioxide. Where do you think it came from? Ultimately, you trace it back to your mitochondria. So these are the little blast furnaces that are all through our bodies. Lysosomes are interesting. They call them suicide packets. They have very potent enzymes packed in them. And one of the things that happens when you die is they all seem to burst. It's a self-destruct system. One reason we begin to break down so rapidly after death is the release of lysosomes. Now they think, this is theoretical at this point, but they think that aging is a slow release of lysosomes. So a slow death is growing old and having lysosomes that slowly break open, giving arthritis and other difficulties that we find increasing as we age. Endoplasmic reticulum represents this labyrinth of membrane ramifying back and forth, folded and convoluted so many times. And that is like a workbench. It serves several purposes. It carves the cytoplasm into workrooms. So one project is going on in this room and another project in another room, and the chemicals don't get confused, separating enzymes from each other so things don't get too hopelessly intermixed. But you'll notice all over this network of membrane are little black specks like pepper. Those are the ribosomes. A cell may well have 500,000 ribosomes in it, each of which is a little engineer himself producing proteins according to recipes that are in the nucleus. The fascinating thing is the cookbooks that have all the recipes are not only in the nucleus, they're on closed reserve. You students, you know what it is, when you have to study for an exam, and the book you need is on closed reserve in the library, it means you can't take it home. You got to go in the library and use it. And then you take notes and you come out. Well, this library not only has two sets of every blueprint, it's really greedy about those two sets, they're on closed reserve, but the other obnoxious problem we have in the living cell is that the ribosomes are never permitted in the nucleus. The blueprints are never permitted out. The workmen who should use them are never permitted in. How do we get the message to the guys that need it the most, the guys that are building proteins? Photocopying. The Lord had to put a photocopy long before we ever thought of it. It's called messenger RNA. The DNA of the nucleus is photocopied, if you will, into something called messenger RNA, and just the photocopy of precisely the blueprint that's needed is permitted out of the nucleus and given to the ribosome, who then will take it and make what he needs. Now, how do you keep this whole thing straight? How do you know which recipe to Xerox for this little ribosome down here and which one for this guy over here? And there's millions of ribosomes all over that endoplasmic reticulum, and they all need certain recipes at certain times. Somebody's behind this, keeping this thing under control. That nucleus, well, you know, the naturalistic view is to say, well, the nucleus is doing it. Yeah, but the nucleus is essentially the library. Where's the librarian? I mean, what is keeping this thing running properly? It is just fascinating as you look at it. Can you imagine stumbling upon a New York City and saying, well, everything's just going on its own? There's no rhyme or reason, there's no direction, there's no authority. No, you cannot have a functioning city with transportation, power plants, and all these things happening if there isn't some wisdom here, some system of control. There's many other things we could talk about. I won't get into them unless you have any questions on any of them. Any questions on that overhead? I just want you to see what is the effect of miniature city. Golgi apparatus, Golgi body, I didn't mention. That's a packaging plant that packages things up, transports them to the membrane where they're released and taken away to other cells that need them. So there's communication from cell to cell as well within a cell. We have not just a city, but we have a nation of cities. And the body, as you know, is well organized so that from one city to another. If this were a pancreatic cell, it would be in the business of making insulin, and the pancreas makes insulin, which is then used elsewhere in the body. If it's the liver, maybe making bile, and then shipped to where it's needed. Okay. I told you I was a botanist, and that didn't sound much like botany, did it? That was mostly animal stuff, so let me jump to my first love, plants, and give you a taste of the glory of God. Still in the single cell, but getting a little more botanical about it. Here is a typical leaf in cross-section. If you were to take a razor blade and just chop up any normal green leaf, as they're indicating here, they have this little circle, little black circle, which then they're going to enlarge. And we're trying to think in three dimensions now. You're going to see on the upper edge of the leaf what we call the upper epidermis, and on top of that a waxy layer called the cuticle. Very similar structure on the bottom, a lower epidermis with a waxy cuticle. Waxy cuticle obviously is necessary to prevent an undue loss of water vapor from these cells. The upper layer of what's called the mesophyll is called the palisade cells. If you've ever been to the Hudson River and seen the palisades, you can appreciate this upright columnar appearance of these things. Beneath that, and they're rather tightly packed, beneath them are rather loosely packed spongy mesophyll cells with lots of airspace between them. In this airspace, gases can collect, as you've shown in this part of the diagram here, and then gases are exchanged with the atmosphere through little openings called stomata. Stoma is the Greek word for mouth, and so the leaf is said to have little mouths. Indeed, if you look under a microscope at the surface of a leaf, you'll see many of these little openings with guard cells, and the guard cells open and close, regulating the amount of gases that can go in and out. The plant is doing just the opposite of what we do. It's releasing oxygen and using carbon dioxide. At least in the daylight, that is the process. At night, plants reverse, and they do pretty much what we do. But by day, they're producing an excess of oxygen, using up CO2. That makes for a very happy balance on our planet between the green plants and us. You may have seen the little bumper sticker, "Have you thanked the green plant today for your oxygen?" And they're getting rid of your CO2 for you. Okay, it looks pretty innocent. It's sophisticated, but nothing perhaps that we marvel over that much. What we are about to do now is to take one such cell, as they indicate here. If you notice where it says chloroplast, and it's pointing to one, just one of these somewhat shady spots. A chloroplast is not something you can see very well with a light microscope. You can see it shining like a little green jewel, but you can't really visualize much of what is inside a chloroplast. We are now going to have to shift to an electron microscope to get somewhat better resolution. Before I do that, let me just show you one other real nice cross-section here. Here's one that's more colorful, essentially showing the same sorts of structures. Cuticle on the top, an epidermal layer, which incidentally the epidermal layer has no chloroplast. They're showing it here as yellow. then the Palisades with their many chloroplasts, all those little green spots, millions and millions of chloroplasts, spongy mesophyll, lower epidermal layer, lower cuticle, and stoma that open up, allow the gases to go in and out. Okay, now the electromicrograph. We want to try to visualize a plant cell with a little more resolution. We're going to magnify this particular cell 14,000 times. You cannot do that with a light microscope. There's two pictures here. The top one is an actual electron micrograph taken with a transmission electron microscope in which you have to prepare a very thin section of leaf tissue. Then beneath it is an artist's conception of the same thing, making it a little more colorful and easy for us to follow. The nucleus is the purple object. A plant has a rigid cell wall. Unlike the membrane of the animal cell, the plant cell has a cellulose wall that gives a lot of rigidity. If there were not the case, your tomato plants couldn't stand up at all. The reason plants can stand upright is their cellulose in their cell walls, combined with the turgor pressure of water pressing internally against those walls. They have no skeleton, such as we do, so they're hydrostatic, if you will. They stand up with water pressure. A plant cell is an amazingly empty structure. Large vacuoles are very characteristic. And as we look through the electron microscope, we usually find the cytoplasm then pressed up against the edge. And of course, in a green plant, one of the striking organelles is the chloroplast. And here we see about six of them in this particular plant cell. Some plants may have considerably more, some fewer, but that's probably average to find six of these in a given cell. Okay. Starch grains you see in the chloroplast, that's the accumulation of sugars that are being produced by photosynthesis. They're pitched together in long starch molecules and then stored like starch grains. But what we want to do at this point is go a little deeper. We want to magnify this thing still more. So here comes one chloroplast. We're going to now single out one chloroplast and take a closer look. Once again, we have the actual electron micrograph, and now we have the artist conception beside it. And I will work from the artist diagram. Grana refers to a stack of what looks like pennies, or a stack of pancakes, if you will, that have been sliced through. And there are many such stacks throughout the chloroplast, looking like somewhat shaded rectangles. But as we take a close look, we see there are pancakes, if you want to call them that. This is what I like to refer to them as. Each pancake is called a phyllopoid. So if you can picture a stack of pancakes, one skinny pancake is a phyllopoid, a whole stack of them is a granum, and more than one granum is grana, plural. And we have taken our knife, if you will, and sliced through all of them. So there's hundreds and hundreds of pancakes inside this chloroplast in stacks, and we've just cut through all the stacks in one shot. All around the pancakes are the syrup, and the syrup is called the stroma. The stroma is that semi-liquid substance, semi-solid gel around the pancakes. And then, of course, the whole chloroplast has an outer and inner membrane, and there's a lot of activity going on in here, too. You still with me now? We've moved from that leaf to that, let's say, spongy mesophyll cell. We've taken just one mesophyll cell with chloroplast. We've cut through that. We've reached in and taken one chloroplast. We've magnified that probably 100,000 times now. And we're looking at some of the fine structure inside that shiny green chloroplast. We haven't told you where the chlorophyll is hiding yet. There's a pigment in there somewhere, too, but we'll get to that shortly. Here's a nice little review overhead that'll help us get our perspective. We start with the cell. We pull up the chloroplast. Here's the chloroplast here, looking like a green M&M you've bitten into. Instead of finding chocolate inside, you have all these little stacks of pancakes and the syrup. Here are the stacks of the phyllopoids with interconnecting membranes. They're somewhat interconnected. And if you cut through the pancakes and look closely, you're going to find they're hollow. These are hollow pancakes. So we call the interior of the phyllopoid. The phyllopoid has a phyllopoid membrane, and it's got an empty interior. Well, not really empty, but at least hollowed out. There's something going on in there, too, which we'll see shortly. Our next step, then, is to take a look at just one pancake. We're going to take a look at the hollow cavity of the interior of just one thylakoid. Now, at this point, we no longer have this kind of resolution, so I cannot show you any more electron micrographs. I can merely show you artist conceptions. The man I mentioned at Cornell, Dr. Jagendorf, is responsible for a fair amount of what we have learned about this interior of a pancake. It turns out it's a lot like your car battery. It's got a lot of acid in it. These pancakes aren't going to be quite so tasty after all. They are generating acid. As the sun shines on the plant, and here we see photons coming in, a very complicated mechanism is going on here, which I can't even begin to explain to you tonight. And I'm not sure I understand it myself. But suffice it to say, the upshot of this very complicated electron transport system is to pump hydrogen ions and concentrate them inside the pancake. And when you concentrate hydrogen ions, That, by definition, is acid. You are creating an acid battery. Now, what good is this battery? Well, there's no electrodes in it. We're not lighting any light bulbs with this thing. The productivity, if you will, of this little tiny battery is that the hydrogen is then allowed to leak back out again, having concentrated it while the sun is shining, perhaps during the night or when the plant calls for the energy. The hydrogens are permitted to escape through a thin pore. And again, what's going on here is extremely complicated, but if we try to put it into some kind of metaphor that we can understand, think of these hydrogens being told that before they can leave, they have to run a treadmill. And they run this treadmill, and as they run it, they power something. This is an enzyme, the CFO, CF1 complex, ATP synthetase, is an enzyme that takes a low-energy compound called ADP plus an inorganic phosphorus and highly energizes it into ATP. You may recall I used that word earlier in the lecture. ATP is a very high-energy compound used through all of life to make anything work. You're sitting here right now not doing a whole lot except very politely trying to stay awake, but even that effort is burning up ATP. Now, if you're picking up a pencil and taking any notes, that's requiring ATP. Just keeping your brain illuminated, your eyes open, and your heart beating, and your lungs working, everything you do requires ATP. You can't move the smallest finger, flex the slightest muscle, but that you're burning up thousands of molecules of ATP. The body and the plant, likewise, are generating ATP constantly and burning it up constantly at a phenomenal rate. And there's never too much excess. The body regulates ATP to an amazing degree. It makes it as you need it. Now, you're making it from the food that you eat. The oxygen that you breathe and the food that you eat in your mitochondria, the little blast furnaces I showed you, is where you're making your ATP. The plant has mitochondria. It, too, can burn food and make it. But it also has this apparatus, which makes more than enough ATP. And that's why our food ultimately is traced back to green plants. You've probably thought about this before, but everything you eat ultimately goes back to sunshine. Now you think about the hamburger, well, cow eats the grass, sunshine. So any food chain you think of, we ultimately trace back to photosynthesis. It's this process going on inside the thylakoid that is responsible for every living thing with the rare exception. The Lord has a neat sense of humor. He always has to put one little wrinkle in there to be different, the chemosynthetic bacteria. So if I stand here tonight and tell you that all life depends on photosynthesis, one of you guys is going to come up to me, somebody will come up to me and say, wait a minute. How about the chemosynthetic bacteria that don't use photosynthesis? They use chemicals to make ATP. That's right. The Lord did put an exception out there. But as far as we can tell, chemosynthetic bacteria don't feed you or me or any other part of our food chain. They are just an interesting little wrinkle I think the Lord put there to say, see, I can do things differently if I want to. But basically, this is what drives all of life. Okay, we're down on a fairly small scale, looking at one pancake and the interior of it, trying to understand how food is made. I now want to look at this membrane. We have looked at what's the acid being concentrated in the middle of the pancake. Let's take a little bit closer look at the batter, if you will, the thin layer of dough that made the pancake. Here you see they've drawn a small circle, and they're trying to enlarge that thylakoid membrane. Like any membrane in living systems, it's what's called a lipid bilayer. There are lipid molecules that line up with their hydrophilic heads outward, meaning water-loving heads face outward, and their hydrophobic tails point inward. And embedded in this lipid bilayer are large proteins and enzymes, and more than just proteins, photosystems. You see they've labeled here photosystem, and they show these orange blocks. We're moving deeper into this labyrinth of sophisticated engineering. And we're going to find there's a tremendous amount happening in these little blocks called photosystems. This is where the action's at. This is where the sun is shining. This is where the photons are going. This is where the real energy is being used and harnessed. What's going on in the photosystem? You can see why my students are groaning by now in my biology course. I always tell them, I say, the way I design my introductory biology course, it's a little bit like climbing a mountain and then coming down the other side. It's about the middle of the semester that we get to cellular respiration and photosynthesis. And I say, if you can master this, and believe me, this is elementary. This is as simple as we can make it. I am feeding you photosynthesis in the most pablum form I can make. It's far more complex than this. But I say to my students, if you can possibly master what we're doing in this chapter, it'll be all downhill from here. It's all easier once we get past respiration and photosynthesis. And with that, they take a deep breath and they try to climb the summit of Mount Everest in their biological expedition. And I can see why they are disheartened when I come to this next overhead, because I get disheartened myself sometimes looking at this. These are the photosystems. And again, this is about as simple as we can make it. There's a lot more happening here than what we're showing. A photosystem is a conglomeration of about 400 chlorophyll molecules. A lot of pigment molecules clustered together. And I'll be showing you in a few minutes what a real chlorophyll molecule looks like, what its atomic structure is. But it's shaped a little bit like a skillet. You can imagine a whole bunch of skillets with long handles, little frying pans, all nestled within each other, all packed together. And when a photon hits one of these chlorophyll molecules, some of which are chlorophyll A and some are chlorophyll B, there's different types of chlorophyll, these things begin to shake. They get all excited. A photon of light has come in, the chlorophyll molecule has been struck, and the thing begins to jiggle. And it bumps the guy next to it, because he's right up against it. And that chlorophyll molecule begins to jiggle. And then he passes on to the next one. So we have a whole series of these things beginning to shake and jiggle. When it gets to the very center molecule of chlorophyll, it's like 350 or 400 surrounding it, but it gets to the guy in the middle, he gets so excited that, zing, he shoots an electron off. An electron actually departs from his molecule and goes way up, energetically speaking, goes way up the scale. So what we're showing here is in photosystem 1, this E minus refers to the electron that's finally released from the photosystem. It goes way up to a much higher voltage, and then it begins to drop. And as it drops, it is passed along through a whole series of chemicals that are called electron transport systems. They're just showing a few here, bound pyridoxine, soluble pyridoxine, and then a type of compound that's reduced, NADP to NADBH. Meanwhile, over in photosystem 2, an electron is released. It doesn't go quite as high, but it drops through a series of plastic quinones, cytochromes, plasticinin, and finally enters photosystem 1. And notice the wiggly line photons coming in that get the thing excited and cause it to do it again and again and again. What's the point of all this? Well, what's important in all this is this reduced compound, NADPH. Sort of like the ATP, it is a temporary energy-holding compound that will be used later to do some very important things. But this is just the photosystem, and this is a grossly simplified view of a photosystem embedded in that batter of that pancake we were looking at, embedded in that thylakoid membrane. Okay, let me just show you what a chlorophyll molecule looks like. If you can picture one of these photosystems having in it 400 of these beautiful chlorophyll molecules, this is what the skillet looks like. The thing that really gets excited in here when it's hit by a photon, and the thing that finally releases the electron, is this magnesium atom right in the center. There's one magnesium atom surrounded by numerous carbon, nitrogen, hydrogen atoms, as you can see, and then a long phytol tail. This is called the porphyrin ring, similar to a structure we find in hemoglobin. And then a long phytol tail that's embedded in the lipids of the membrane. That's one skillet. And we can see there the beauty and the symmetry, even at the atomic level. We're down to atoms now, and we see the beauty and the symmetry. Of course, I guess the men who shatter the atoms find a lot of beauty and symmetry, too, between all the neutrinos and the various subatomic particles that are in there. But this is as far as we're going tonight. We're not going to shatter atoms tonight. But we're down to that beautiful structure, one chlorophyll molecule, of which there would be, like I say, 400 in the photosystem. There'd be hundreds of photosystems in a stack of thylakoids in a granum. There'd be hundreds of granum in a chloroplast, hundreds and thousands of chloroplasts in a portion of a leaf. And you can just see how many of these things we're talking about. Okay, that's the pancakes. Any questions on the thylakoid pancakes? Meanwhile, back in the syrup, what's happening in the syrup around the pancakes? This is what we call the Calvin cycle. There was a man in 1953, Melvin Calvin, who elucidated some of the exciting things that are going on in the stroma. That was the stuff all around the pancakes inside the chloroplast. Lots of activity. The Calvin cycle tells us, shows us, thinking God's thoughts after him, shows us how carbon dioxide is admitted into the system, and through a very complex series of biochemical changes mediated by enzymes at every step of the way, and every enzyme is a very large and complex and precise protein, but at each step of the way, mediated by enzymes, we change these carbohydrates into different sugars until finally we reach what we're looking for, and that's glucose. And glucose synthesis is shown down here at the bottom. Carbon dioxide, well, they tell you to start here. They want you to start with 3-ribulose phosphate. You convert that to 3-ribulose biphosphate. That's rather arbitrary. You can start anywhere you want. This is just a cycle that endlessly goes round and round and round. But for some reason, they say start here, just so we can agree where to start. Notice at first we're using up ATP. This process actually requires energy to get going. Carbon dioxide is fixed. It comes around, forms all these different sugars. Eventually, glucose is funneled off, and that's what we're trying to make. Glucose is the building block of glycogen, starch, cellulose. It's the building block of a lot of our nutrition. Blood sugar, glucose is referred to as blood sugar. If you're feeling weak and faint, they say you better check your blood sugar. Glucose is what we're speaking of. So most of the foods that you eat, your body has the chemistry to convert to glucose, to break things down and make glucose. the plant is going to make glucose from which things can then be built up and synthesized from it. So it's a major organic building block. We go round and round the cycle using energy as we do, using NADPH, the reduced compound we saw in the last thing with the photosystem, using up ATP. So one reason the plant has to make a lot of ATP and has to make a lot of this other fancy compound is that the Calvin cycle will use them, burn them up in the process of making glucose. The energy then is stored in the bonds of the glucose. Later, when you eat the maple syrup from the maple tree and get the glucose, you will break those bonds, you will get that energy back out again. But you see that both the pancakes and the syrup, as I somewhat jokingly like to call them, are just rich with chemistry, biochemistry, pathways, enzymes, structure that is very sophisticated. Okay, at this point I'm going to leave the single cell. Is there any questions on what we looked at there? I want to go down another step. What time do you normally conclude the lecture?
9 o'clock.
9 o'clock, okay. We'll try to wrap this up.
Question. Would you define an enzyme?
An enzyme is a catalyst that mediates a chemical reaction, but it's an organic catalyst. I'm not much of an inorganic chemist, but there certainly are catalysts that inorganic chemists use. We often think of our catalytic converter that tries to change our exhaust into something a little more pleasant to the EPA in the atmosphere. A catalyst is something that in the process of mediating a chemical reaction is not permanently changed or altered, and it's available to do the task again. The way I normally like to explain it to students, it's like it comes along to us, what they call a substrate, the chemical, these sugars, for example, that need to be changed in some way. And the enzyme sort of puts pressure on them, gets a hold of them and twists them and bends them until their bonds are ready to break, and it brings in another carbon or another organic molecule, and it sticks it on there, and so it forms just the molecule it's trying to make. If you didn't have the enzyme, you could do the same task at much higher temperatures. As we heat up, let's say we heat up some of these sugars, for example, they would bump into each other by sheer molecular motion at high temperatures, and they would hit each other occasionally in random motion. They would hit each other just right to make the same compounds we're looking at in the Calvin cycle, but it would require a tremendous amount of heat. There'd be a lot of waste. The enzyme can do it at a much lower temperature with much less waste and incredible efficiency, a fantastic rate of speed, mediate these chemical reactions.
How many kinds of enzymes are there?
I don't know. It's, you know, it's like insects. We've been discovering more all the time. We just keep finding more enzymes. I don't even know if anyone's tallied them up where we stand. You know, the plants and animals, I think it would be safe to say millions of enzymes. Maybe I'm over-exaggerating there, have been identified. Certainly, I think safe saying hundreds of thousands have been identified and labeled. But I'm sure everyone you'd speak to would say there are many more to be found, that we are just scratching the surface here, too, what's out there. Good questions. Thank you for that. I often say to my students, you know, you're sitting here at 98.6. That's your average body temperature. And you're sitting here digesting your supper now tonight at 98.6. If you didn't have enzymes, you would have to have a blast furnace running at probably 1,000 degrees to try to accomplish the same task of what you're getting done very comfortably at a low temperature. Okay, the next thing I want to look at is the glory of God as revealed in the ribosome. And I just want to see, here it is, the original overhead that we started the whole evening with, the animal cell, the idealized animal cell. Remember that the ribosomes are the pepper in this picture. Here is our cell with its endoplasmic reticulum, and all these little black specks represent roughly half a million to a million ribosomes per cell. What can we see with the electron microscope? Not a whole lot. Again, scientists have other techniques besides actually visualizing. I have to marvel, and you must hats off to the scientists who can fathom and discover what's happening in these cells, because many times they're beyond the reach of their microscopes. They're beyond the resolution. And yet, there's no doubt in my mind that what they're finding is true and accurate. And many times we later have other tests that can check the answers they've achieved, and yes, they're right. And with more sophisticated microscopic techniques, occasionally we do get a glimpse of what they have hypothesized from other techniques and say, look at that, just like they said. The very fact that ribosomes do cling to messenger RNA, as we're going to see in a moment, and read these photocopies was something that was suggested, and then later it was visualized. Barely visualized, we're right at the thresholds of our ability to see what's going on, but there it is. We see long chains of ribosomes moving along, reading messenger RNA, Xerox recipes, if you will. So we're going to be looking at these tiny little dots, some of which have been visualized, some of which is hypothesized from chemical tests and other techniques. That I believe is a fairly accurate picture of what's happening in the cell. The ribosome, if we can enlarge him, is like a two-lobed snowman. Here you see this sort of a loop and a smaller loop, and then you see the word ribosome there. They're trying to portray not only the structure of this thing, but some of the activity. What's this
creature doing? What is this organelle accomplishing? How does it do it? The blue line, labeled mRNA, messenger RNA, is the recipe, if you will. I'm going to use a cook analogy at this point. That's a recipe. It's a Xerox recipe. It was Xerox back in the nucleus in the library and printed out. And this ribosome was about to read it three letters at a time. These recipes are built of what's called nucleotides. DNA and RNA assist the repeating subunits called nucleotides. There are only four or five different types of nucleotides. In RNA, there's four different letters, A, G, U, and C. But the sequence they're in is very important. Just like our English language only has 26 letters, but I've been lecturing you tonight for over 50 minutes using those 26 letters in all kinds of patterns that you've understood audibly as words of the English language. And this is a language. This is a chemical language using four letters in three-letter words. It limits itself to three-letter words, four letters each. It's called the genetic code. And the ribosome can read that language, and as it reads them three letters at a time, it knows which amino acid to go for. And so if it's just read AGA, and it says that is arginine, and ARG up here in the little box represents that particular amino acid specified in the recipe, the ribosome is the instrument, if you will, that reads the recipe and then reaches out for the amino acid and brings it and connects it to the growing chain of amino acids. Amino acids are forming a long polypeptide, and this thing reaches out, grabs the next ingredient in just the right order. Now, it's being assisted in its task by other complicating factors. I'm persuaded the Lord loves complexity, just to humble us. I mean, it's hard to even try to simplify something like this. You see this twisted coat hanger coming in here? This thing in the jig? That's AAU. That's what's called an anticodon in there. It's a transfer RNA. The amino acids can't come in unless they're attached to a transfer RNA, tRNA. So you have messenger RNA, you have tRNA. The tRNA links up with the ribosome, attaches its amino acid, and then when it's finished, it jettisons off and goes off looking for another amino acid at just the right type. So it's really a lot of complicated stuff going on here. But the ribosome, as you can see, is integral to the whole process, and that's the point. The ribosome is the focus of activity, and this is where proteins are being built. Let me just flash another overhead here that will give you more appreciation for the two-lobed snowman. Here they show them three times. Up here at the top, here comes the twisted coat hanger, the transfer RNA. Actually, that one's been released. One has just come in. There's an A site and a P site in the top half of the ribosome. A cysteine has just come in. A glycine has just been attached. What they're going to show now is that a peptide bond will form between the glycine and the cysteine that just came in. The twisted coat hanger transfer RNA will move from the A site to the P site. The old transfer RNA in the P site will be jettisoned out. And another twisted coat hanger transfer RNA will be coming in with its valine. And the ribosome is moving from left to right. Throughout this whole process, he's reading three letter words left to right. And the growing polypeptide is streaming out behind him. And he keeps calling in for new amino acids as he proceeds. So we got the picture now, a cook that sort of crawls along the recipe as he cooks it, as he builds the project. Okay, the question then is, what is this ribosome made of? We say it's a two-lobed snowman. We're picturing it there in sort of an orange color. What kind of structure is there to the ribosome? Scientists have elucidated this much. And believe me, this is a simple ribosome. This is a bacterial ribosome, smaller in size and less complex than you'd find in a human or a large animal or plant. This is a bacterial ribosome that has a molecular weight of 1,600,000. That's just the large subunit. The smaller lobe is 900,000. What does that consist of? 34 different proteins, ranging in molecular weight from 9,000 to 28,500, and two RNA molecules, molecular weights 1,036,000, these twisted things here. All of this is the constituents of the upper lobe, the larger lobe of the ribosome. And what I want you to notice here is that there are 34 very distinct, rather large, precise proteins that go into this lobe of the ribosome. And down here are 21 additional large, very precise proteins that go into the lower lobe and another molecule of RNA. These are all the basic building blocks that go into a ribosome. We finally end up with a submicroscopic chicken and egg problem. You've all heard which comes first, the chicken or the egg. The question here is which comes first, the ribosome, which is absolutely essential for the production of any protein, or the manifold many proteins that go into the ribosome. You see, the recipe for the cooks is embedded in the library and the cookbooks too. Your cells, for example, we have 23 different cookbooks in the human cell, 46 cookbooks altogether, a double set. You have a double set of 23 different cookbooks in every nucleus, every cell of your body. And in all that information is also embedded the information how to make all these different proteins that make up the ribosomes, who are in the process of making proteins. You cannot have these kinds of proteins without ribosomes, and you cannot have ribosomes without proteins. And pray tell which comes first, the chef or the cookbook that tells you how to make chefs. It's a very sophisticated system that's up and running as we find it. The last thing I'm going to hit you with in the last few minutes is the virus, because sometimes people have said, good grief, you're right, the single cell is like a city. It's just marvelous, and it's making cooks and doing all these things. And how about the virus? Simple, lowly virus. Surely there, perhaps we have found that magic evolutionary link that will help us understand how life began in the oceans. Maybe the virus was the first thing that formed, and only much later did we have cells. And so I just want to consider with you viruses for a moment. There's a Donald Duck comic strip that was very helpful to me. Uncle Ludwig was in his white lab coat. Donald Duck comes in to see him in the laboratory and says to him, Uncle Ludwig, what's a virus? And Uncle Ludwig says, oh, it's a teeny tiny thing. Donald Duck says, oh, you mean a bug? He says, no, much smaller than a bug. He says, oh, you mean a germ? And he says, no, much smaller than a germ. And then he pauses for a minute and he thinks and he says, actually, he says, a virus is a germ's germ. And that's a very nice definition. Because there's a whole class of viruses out there called bacteriophage, and they are precisely that. They are far smaller than a bacterium, and they infect bacteria and kill them. They multiply, and the bacteria lyses, breaks open, and dies. So a germ's germ both gives you a sense of the scale, a magnitude of size. It also is a fairly accurate representation of at least some viruses and what they do. One of those viruses that affects bacteria was studied in 1977 by a man named Dr. Sanger, who sequenced every nucleotide in that virus. See, viruses have DNA and RNA in them too. They're made of the same blueprints that we have in our cookbooks. And so a virus is simply a runaway recipe, if you will. It's a recipe gone wild that cooks pick up and cook wrongly, accidentally. That's why I say viruses are not living at all. They're just recipes. They can't cook. They can't make anything. They're a recipe that some dumb cook has to be dumb enough to cook. Some dumb cook finds the virus and he makes it. And when he does, it's to his own destruction, into the whole kitchen, into the whole cell. He does it to the destruction and eventually the whole organism if it keeps spreading. So a virus, then, is a runaway wild recipe. Dr. Sanger, in 1977, was the first scientist to really sequence any known genome. Today, you know what the big project is that billions of your tax dollars are going into? Scientists are sequencing the human genome. Those 23 cookbooks in every nucleus, they are spending the next 10, 15, 20 years and billions of dollars to try to sequence exactly what makes up the human genome. It's a lot of work. There's a lot of information in there. They're going to be at it for a long time. But Dr. Sanger in 1977 cracked open the door on this whole endeavor by decoding, if you will, something that's called 5chi-174. We won't worry about its name. That's just the code name of the virus. But what he did is he looked at the strand of, in this case, RNA. Some viruses have DNA, some have RNA. This particular little virus had a strand of, I believe, RNA. And he said, okay, let's read the letters. Adenine, cytosine, uracil, guanine, uracil, adenine, cytosine, uracil, cytosine. I'm making these up. I'm just being arbitrary. But that's how it works. You only have four letters to work from. They're in a sequence, and they are read by ribosomes in units of three. And so what Dr. Sanger discovered was that he could identify every message in this little virus, exactly what protein it was calling for, and then he figured out what that protein was doing. Some of it was the coat protein that wraps the virus. Some of it was enzymes that did nasty things that the virus wanted to accomplish, making more viruses instead of making the cell healthy. But to his amazement, when he was finished, he said, I can't believe what I'm looking at. Because when he had carefully studied the genome of this virus, he said, there are two messages in here, and they're on top of each other. The virus, in order to conserve size, has compressed information in such a way that I can now go back, and indeed the ribosome goes back, the ribosome that's making all this stuff, starts over again, and just moves over one letter, skips the A, and says, I'm going to read C-U-G, and then I'm going to read G-U-U, and U-A-A, and C-U-C, and C-C-C, and I'm going to call for a new sequence of amino acids. Now, up until this point, scientists knew that occasionally things like this happened by mistake. A ribosome attaches at the wrong place, a recipe gets damaged, and a letter gets bumped off the end. We call that a frame shift mutation. When a ribosome gets on the trolley car in the wrong place and reads the thing, it makes a protein okay, but it's just a bunch of garbage. It's called protein junk, a polypeptide that just rolls up in a ball and doesn't do anything. If it's supposed to be an enzyme, it has no enzymatic function. It simply is a disaster. You know, you can tolerate one amino acid out of place sometimes. Sometimes one amino acid will do you in. But you can't tolerate every amino acid being bumped out of place. When you frame shift the whole thing, it's almost always a lethal mutation. You destroy whatever it is you have. Let's look at it in English for a minute. I think we get the picture. If I write a simple English sentence, and I say, the boy saw the cat run, we can tolerate one blowout. If I knock the E off the word the, you'd probably fill it in again and say it was the boy. But if I frame shift the whole message, if I recut the words and start here and I write H-E-B and O-Y-S and A-W-T and H-E-C and A-T-R, so I end up with a message that reads heb, voice, out, heck, atter, un. We say, forget it, man. That's not telling me anything. Can you imagine? And I've talked to some men who did this kind of thing in the military, folks who work in cryptography and intelligence, and how they would love to find a code that works like this. So you hand a soldier a novel, but he moves over one letter, and there's the message, bomb Pearl Harbor, embedded in this novel. Go home tonight, ladies, and take your Better Homes and Gardens cookbook off the shelf, and take any recipe you wish, and frame shift, and see if you find another recipe embedded in your cherry cobbler recipe as a recipe for beef stew. Yeah, it's just not going to happen. It will never, never happen. Not only will it not happen by chance, but we cannot do it by effort. Scientists or cryptographers can look at this and they say, we wish we could do this kind of thing, but we can't. Now, we can think God's thoughts after him, and we can see what God has done at this level, but we can't emulate that. We can only marvel at it. That's the sophistication. That's the wisdom that the Lord chose to put in the germ's germ. And that's why I think the Lord laughs at heaven on high when he sees the scientists find this. It was his glory to conceal it. It was their glory to find it. But where does the glory really end, and where should the focus of the glory rest? Is it not the engineer who invented the code? You know, when this was first discovered, you could hear a pin drop, I like to say, figuratively speaking, in the scientific community. When something like this is discovered, there's a sharp breath from business. I don't believe what I'm looking at. I can't believe this level of sophistication. But then they go on their way saying, isn't Mother Nature a most creative woman? And we just brush it aside again. And we know we can't do it with all of our wisdom and all of our powers. Well, I hope tonight you've had a glimpse of the glory of God as revealed in different microscopes and even beyond the microscope. Are there any questions on those four levels?
Does this shift does happen?
This does happen, that's right.
Is it at all talking?
No, as a matter of fact, I've been watching the literature at a distance. I don't have access to the literature, but I went to Cornell and I Xeroxed a lot of the articles that related to this. And to my knowledge, nobody has found this overlap between the higher organisms yet. It'd be most fascinating is to do the human genome to see if perhaps we'll find an example somewhere in our chromosomes. Right now, they believe we have a lot of excess DNA, but the human genome has a lot of junk DNA that doesn't have any purpose. Too much potential information, more than they think they need. That may go the way of the appendix, however. They used to think we didn't need our tonsils and our appendix, too. And that sort of thing, maybe we ought to hang on to them. So they may find the DNA in our cookbooks really is used, and they may run into something like this. But for the moment, it seems to be in the virus, which may be all the Lord ever did with it. To say, ha-ha, you thought the virus was a little simple evolutionary length of a little cell. Look at this one. How do you explain that little bit of evolution? Oh, it's such a simple entity. Yes.
What happened to so?
A new protein is made that is good and essential to the reproduction of that virus. It's a necessary protein, a functional protein. So this thing has several proteins that it needs, and like I say, compress that information content and put it into one tiny little recipe or over the back of its recipes. And that's the sheer beauty of it, because that makes the virus still very small. This bacteria requires a very small space and a very limited range of nucleotides. You get double its money's worth of recipes. And so we'd do another book. If you could write a book that had two books at home, a couple of your mind. And not necessarily. This is, by the way, this is just one virus. We can talk about viruses in a large field. Just a plant virus alone, it's thousands upon thousands of the name now plant viruses. This is a bacteria type virus, the animal viruses, the human viruses. And how long they stay, how stable they are, really varies tremendously from virus to virus. Some are very unstable. Unfortunately, the AIDS virus is not a very stable one. So out of the atmosphere, they're not quickly generated. There are things like tobacco mosaic virus that affect plants. They can crystallize with
kitchen uniform and put up in a shelf and bottle and sit there for 30 or 40 years and take it off, resolubilize it, give it to some aphids, and go back and infect the tobacco plants and still cause disease. So some are very sick. That was what my PhD was on, by the way. Virus of sweet corn. A sweet corn virus. Lots of fun.
Does that also have organ occupation?
The only thing I'm aware of is this one, Thaikai 174. I haven't seen anybody really find it in the grass. But if anybody hears about something like that, let me know. That will help us keep up with it. Yes, depending how you define wood, some of the beautiful tulip break pollen where they breed all these tulips, some of your most beautiful broken colors are in virus infection. I don't know if there's anything good for humans. At least in the plant world, we'll consider that good with the colors they like.
How would you define a virus?
Good question. Okay, good question. I struggle to define it. Normally in plant pathology, we would say it's a submicroscopic infectious entity consisting of a strand of nucleic acid and a protein coat. Now that's pretty satisfactory in the botanical realm. Once you start moving to human and animal viruses, it gets more complicated. They often have more than a protein coat. They may have a little bit of enzyme packaged in them, they may have some lipids wrapping them. But I think what is fair to say about all of them is they're obligate parasites. Let's get that word in the word. All viruses, germs, animals, germs, human viruses, bacteria viruses, plant viruses, can be called an obligate parasite. And what that means is they must be a parasite. They're obligated to be a parasite. They cannot subsist on their own. A virus, by definition and by structure, cannot do respiration, photosynthesis, metabolism, reproduction. They can't do anything on their own. They're obligated to enter a host cell. They're obligated to be a parasite. And it's only as they enter some sort of host cell, be that bacterial, plant, or animal, or human, as they go in, the cell itself takes over. The machinery of the cell makes more of them, reproduces them on their behalf. That's why I call it sort of like hijacking. They hijack the cell. They're a recipe gone wild, but you introduce that wild recipe into the cell. Here's the ribosome just waiting for recipe. And for some reason, these ribosomes go berserk. They take this foreign recipe, they begin to produce it. The recipe usually calls for more recipes. So what you find, if you look at a picture of a plant cell that's infected with long tobacco mosaic virus, TMV is like a long rod shape, you'll find the cytoplasm of an infected cell is locally just packed. Like a hairy bone, just packed tight with these virus particles. Until finally the whole cell is full of them. And then somehow they spread to the neighboring cell, little interconnections, they go to the next cell. And so you might look at a cross-section of a leaf with a whole series of cells packed full of virus particles. All the goodies in the cell have been turned into viruses. They simply said, take all your constituents, all your building blocks, and make me more and more and more of me. Until finally they die. Now, there are some viruses that are not that virulent, and they good parasite learns how to coexist with its host, and so they aren't quite so demanding. The ones that are less demanding, the host still lives and the virus still survives. If you're too demanding, you kill your host, you defeat your purpose, you die with it. And so you see this range of activity in pathology. You might say they've learned to not be so nasty, so they might have a host. But that's what happens, they just reproduce, or they are reproduced by the host. Yes.
One good thing you can use by viruses is for a certain material that
that's a good system. And in particular, they're using retroviruses to carry some of the stuff in, and that's what AIDS virus is. Complicated with a backwards virus, plays them backwards. Retro. Yeah, viruses themselves are a fascinating study. I opened by big mouth my sophomore year in college in a botany class. The professor asked if they were dead or alive, and I started spelling out what I thought they were doing. Sentence the whole class where they came from was so good. That lost all my friendships that I had in the class, but it also started me down a career of plant pathology. It's been steering me to the whole field because I love viruses so much. I just wanted to pursue them and force them to get to the better. Any other questions? Yes, please.
One question. Once the ribosome makes the protein with the string of amino acids, how does that chain then go to the place where it's supposed to?
How does it get to its location?
How does it get to its location?
I'm not sure we really know that. consider all the locations in the cytoplasm where these things we would have to get to. Probably a lot of them are made. You figure the endoplasmic reticulum ramifies the cytoplasm. Ribosomes are pretty ubiquitous throughout the cytoplasm. Probably things are made close to where they're going to be used for the most part. Now, if it's a protein even outside the cell will package it. That's what the Golgi apparatus is all about. You make a protein, you seal it up in a little vesicle, which is the same lipid bilayer membrane. You ship it to this membrane here. The membrane fuses. The droplet material is exited. And then from there, the body, the gland, this might be in the gland concentrates through ducts, will ship it to where it's needed. But within the cell, I don't know all the mechanisms for where it's from. Proteins are a lot of fun. They have four levels of structure. They have what's called a primary structure. It's just a sequence of amino acids. That string of amino acids coils up in what's called an alpha helix. The alpha helix begins to bend around on itself at a tertiary level structure, which is called the, what is that, tertiary structure. It looks like a slinky. If you ever had a slinky when you were a kid, those springs, you get them all tangled up. That's what a protein looks like. It looks like a tangled up slinky. And then finally, many proteins have several polypeptides, and I usually change colors of chalk when I'm trying to show my students. But if you can imagine another tangled slinky, completely tangled throughout this slinky, of a different color, its tertiary structure, all tangled up with that one, that's called quaternary structure, the fourth level of structure of a protein. You say, what a tangled mess. But no, it's precisely right. Thousands and thousands of amino acids all tangled together like a ball of yarn after the kitten got done playing with it. Three balls of yarn, if you will. The kitten's got them all tangled together, and yet it's exactly the right shape. Every amino acid has to be just in place. This shape is maintained by what's called hydrogen bonds between different amino acids. Very fragile, weak attractions. And if you tamper with it, sometimes you only can change one amino acid out of hundreds of thousands of amino acids, and the thing won't fold quite right, and it won't work. Take sickle cell anemia. Hemoglobin is sickle cell anemia. It has a few amino acids out of place. It doesn't work right. And it causes a deadly disease, a very harmful, painful disease. The Lord has got these program just one. Both the messages that code for them and then the way they fold together once they're produced. Yes?
Comment, great question. A lot of those proteins, when they're shipped outside, have something called synthetic sequence that sort of causes them to be shunted for sex secretion. But there's a whole class of them that's proteins, very, very important in our lives, at least, and so they're kind of not the best as possible. They are excreted outside themselves. You're dead. But and they clearly don't go through any normal secretory pathway that's been documented so far. So some scientists are saying that they have sort of something put on the shelf and waiting for the new discovery. So that's the answer to the question.
So something to do with that signal.
Well, the whole immune system is just a feature.
I really appreciate the presentation. I have been involved in the knowledge of 9 years. I've often thought of putting together a similar presentation, just looking at the complexity of the human immune system as, again, an example of what they got. This is a beautiful example. It probably represents one in a millionth of the scientific understanding of nature. It shows you how much it has built into this creation.
Hibri would love to have you do a talk. You're welcome.
I probably will do that example.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.